Good day. Today is Sunday, 15th February 2026. And before I begin with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you watch this programme or whatever part of this programme you want to watch, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, I'm going to start this programme today with an absolutely astonishing story that came out of Europe, principally, as I understand it, Britain, though France, Germany, the Netherlands, and I believe that one or two other European countries were involved in peddling this story as well. Yesterday, an astonishing report appeared, or rather, I should say, a statement appeared by all of these European countries, alleging that the Russian authorities had assassinated the former Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny. And that, of course, that claim has been made many times before, including, by the way, as I remember, by Western governments. But providing what they say is information as to how the assassination supposedly was carried out. And unsurprisingly, this investigation, which took 2 years, we're not told, by the way, exactly why it took so long, just saying. But anyway, this investigation, which supposedly took years, and which was in part based on samples of Navalny's body, and again, we're not exactly told how those samples were obtained. Anyway, that investigation, on the basis of those samples and studies of those samples, came to the view, or is claimed to have come to the view, that Navalny was murdered with a secret poison extracted from a Ecuadorian frog, a species of Ecuadorian frog. And the poison in question, we are told, is of a sort that is used in blow darts, or was used in blow darts in olden times by Amazonian tribesmen, and that the Russians have found some way to synthesize this poison so that it is now synthesized in laboratories. And the fact that it was synthesized in a laboratory supposedly proves that Navalny was murdered by a state actor, because only a state actor could possess the resources or the expertise to do that. And that state actor, obviously, must be Russia, in whose prison system Navalny, at the time of his death, found himself. Well, the first thing I have to say is that this extraordinary allegation was received with resounding silence around the world. In Britain, the media carried it for a couple of hours, but by this morning, its apparent absurdity, and I suspect the lack of receptiveness to it of the British public, meant that the British media was starting to drop coverage of the story and have basically given up on it as of the time of making this programme. The United States, which of course has the most extensive resources to analyse poisons and, by the way, to obtain samples and to do all of these things. Anyway, the United States has never associated itself with this astonishing claim. It was never a part of this investigation, and it does not sign the statement. And as far as I'm aware, the American government has made no comment at all about the statement, either supportive or not. And sometimes silence speaks more than a volume of words, And in this instance, the silence of the United States speaks volumes as well. In Russia, they have ridiculed this claim. And I get the sense that around the world, and in many parts of Europe also, they are not interested in it either. Anyway, before I proceed, here perhaps I should express my own view, first of all. The first is that I obviously have not studied any of these documents, any of this evidence, supposedly, that has been provided or which exists, which proves this extraordinary claim. I doubt that this information, this evidence, will ever be made public. When similar allegations of this kind have been made in the past, Western governments never publish the evidence upon which the claim is based. In the absence of evidence, I'm not in a position to assess the claim, but I have to say that I don't just have doubts, I have extremely strong doubts to the point of believing that this story is ridiculous. The first thing to say is that if we're talking specifically about Navalny, the Navalny himself was on the brink of being exchanged by the Russians for people held by the West that the Russians wanted back. I cannot imagine that the Russians would murder him on the eve of such an exchange. Why would they? The idea that Navalny was an important or popular or influential person in Russia is simply wrong, as anybody who has tracked his career knows. Navalny had made the extraordinary decision himself to return to Russia after extensive advice. He was, shall we say, an unusual personality, and I don't mean that in a complimentary way, by the way. He's supposed to have had all sorts of health issues. I think it's more than supposed. I think it is well established that he did indeed have health issues. And frankly, the causes of his death seem to me are more likely, more easily explained by natural causes than by unusual and bizarre poisons. So anyway, there is this issue of complete lack of apparent motive for the Russians to carry out an attack of this kind. And the general facts, the general circumstances of Navalny's death basically strongly argue against it. I've discussed this before in the past. That's the first thing I'm going to say. The second thing I'm going to say is this. This is the third instance that I know of where Western governments, notably the British government, which seems to be at the centre of this particular story, has come up with fantastic claims about a mysterious poison supposedly used by the Russians to murder dissidents, Russian dissidents. So back in 2006, it was polonium-210 in the case of Andrei Litvinenko. In 2018, in the case of the Skripals, it was Novichok. And now we have a mysterious poison synthesized by the Russians based on a poison produced by an Ecuadorian frog. It does seem to me that given how relatively straightforward it would have been to get rid of Navalny, to murder him, in other words, if that is what the Russians had really intended to do, I find it difficult to understand why they would come up with another mysterious, exotic poison of this kind when, as I said, all of the other previous poisons were, backfired on the Russians in all sorts of ways, if you believe what the British in particular and the West in general have been saying about them. I mean, why do the Russians go out of their way to create these strange, mysterious, exotic poisons in that way. It does seem a massively overcomplicated way to go about it. Well, I'm going to add something further. We never really got to the bottom of the Skripal affair, at least not as far as I'm concerned. But the British authorities released a lot more information about the Litvinenko affair than I think they intended. They set up a public inquiry to look into the murder of Litvinenko. And that inquiry was conducted mostly, though not entirely, in public. And the most interesting part about that inquiry, which I have discussed extensively in the past, there is a massive article that I wrote about it back, I think, in 2006 or 7, which you could still find on Consortium News. Anyway, the most interesting fact that came out of the public inquiry is that the exotic, mysterious poison that was supposed to have been used in that case, polonium-210, it turned out was not an exotic, mysterious, or very expensive poison at all. The whole weight of the case was that polonium-210 was only produced in Russia, that it was very rare and incredibly expensive, so that only a Russian state actor would be expected to use it. But expert advice given to the inquiry said the opposite. Polonium-210 is not expensive at all. It is produced in many places, not just in Russia. It cannot be traced back to Russia. The particular sample that was found in Litvinenko's body could not be proved to have come from Russia at all. Why it could even have come from Britain itself, that's all in the inquiry. The judgment of the inquiry itself. Now, that obviously meant that polonium-210 didn't really quite fit the theory of a exotic, mysterious, ultra-secret poison. So in the next strange murder, we had to move on to Novichok. And presumably now that that has exhausted itself, we now have the new poison based on, well, that derives ultimately from an Ecuadorian frog. I have to say that to me, this doesn't seem like the kind of thing the Russians do. It seems to me far more like the sort of thing that you would expect from people who've been reading too many Sherlock Holmes stories, just to say. And you are more likely to find those people in Britain, just saying, than you would in Russia, perhaps. Though, admittedly, the Russians do like Sherlock Holmes rather a lot. Anyway, to say this again, in the absence of any evidence, and given the absurdity, the seeming absurdity of this story, and the lack of truth in the first of these series of stories about mysterious poisons, lack of truth in what was claimed in the Litvinenko case about polonium-210, I'm not just sceptical, I am straightforwardly disbelieving. Now, this is a complicated way to refute a story that many people, of course, consider completely absurd. But then what is the point of these programmes if I don't sit down and go through it all and explain why I, with my particular background, have come to the conclusion that I have? Anyway, why would the British, why would the Europeans come up with a story like this, one which the Americans, of course, are not supporting? Well, the short answer is that the situation in Ukraine, on the battlefield, in the diplomacy, in the sky, in the economic field is turning absolutely catastrophic. And there is, of course, growing pressure in Europe itself to start negotiating, or at least to speaking to the Russians. Emmanuel Macron has been pushing this relentlessly over the last few weeks. Even if he comes with no original ideas, he has sort of backing from the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni. The United States also has been in negotiations with the Russians rather a lot over the last year or so, though nothing substantive has come out of these negotiations at all. Nonetheless, we've had telephone calls between Trump and Putin. We've had a meeting in Anchorage. We have visits by Witkoff and Kushner to Moscow. We have on Tuesday another meeting between Witkoff, Kushner, the Russians and the Ukrainians in Geneva. There's no sign, no reason to think that there's any progress being made in those negotiations whatsoever. But alongside those negotiations, the Americans are also talking to the Russians about resuming economic links. Though, to be frank, I don't think those negotiations are going anywhere either. And the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, actually said as much in the interview he gave to BRICS TV about a week ago. So all of this, of course, is making those who want to take the hardest possible line against Russia extremely uneasy. They don't want negotiations to proceed. They don't want the whole narrative that has been elaborately constructed over the last 25 years that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, is some kind of crazed gangster who murders his opponents and entertains some great elaborate plan to take over Europe. They don't want that narrative to be undermined. They want support for Ukraine to continue, even though there are growing signs, in fact, not just growing signs, there is overwhelming evidence that actual physical material support to Ukraine is flagging at exactly the point when the crises in Ukraine are now coming all together. So the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, gave a speech at the Munich Security Conference. I thought it was vague and unhelpful, ultimately, to the Europeans. He mentioned Ukraine only once. He gave little in the way of verbal support for Ukraine. Certainly very little if you compare with rhetoric from times past. Not just, by the way, from the Biden administration. I mean, remember how General Kellogg, Donald Trump's former peace envoy to Ukraine, how far more supportive of Ukraine he used to be when he was still part of the administration just a few weeks ago. Just saying. In fact, all that Rubio seemed to commit the United States to was leadership in, as he put it, the negotiation process with the Russians. And the United States no longer supplies weapons directly to Ukraine. It does supply weapons to Ukraine, but it launders them through the Europeans, who have to pay vast sums of money for them. That flow of weapons, as I've discussed recently, is a major drain on American arsenals and American resources. It may very soon stop or reduce as well. I have been receiving, over the last 24 hours, reports from the United States, from people in the United States, including one person who, by the way, is well known to people who are involved in independent media, but whom I'm not going to identify by name because this was a private video, email. Anyway, this individual, who is extremely well informed about the situation in the United States, says that there is a massive deployment against Iran underway, that practically all of the US's air refueling tankers are being committed to what is increasingly looking like a massive air operation against Iran, that people who are involved in the military from all areas of the US military are receiving instructions to report to duty ahead of some major operation, which can only be the operation against Iran. If all of this is true, and I, by the way, have absolutely no doubt that it is true, the information I'm getting comes from people who are not only trusted by me, but who are trusted, by the way, by most of you. As I said, some of this information is coming from people who are there, out there, in independent media, and who talk lots about these things. Anyway, I've no doubt that this is true. And, of course, I have no idea how long this operation is going to continue for. The reports yesterday, as I discussed, were that the United States expects an operation that will last several weeks. The Iranians, by contrast, are talking about an open-ended operation, one which will last indefinitely until the Americans begin serious negotiations which take into better or more responsible account Iran's conditions for ending the standoff, not America's conditions for ending the standoff. I've said that the Chinese and the Russians are taking huge steps, increasing steps, to support Iran, and that a superpower confrontation over Iran is now looking increasingly likely. Well, given that all of this is so, it is completely unsurprising that the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, might be saying to himself, that the Americans might be saying to themselves, that Marco Rubio might be communicating to the Europeans in Munich, and the Americans might be communicating to the Europeans, and to, by the way, to the Ukrainians, all together, that the United States can no longer maintain the flow of arms to Ukraine, either directly, that of course ended months ago, or indirectly through weapons laundered through Europe, because the United States simply doesn't have the productive capabilities to do that. It needs to use all of the weapons for itself, husband all of these weapons for itself, in order that it can also use them in the Middle East. And speaking of the Middle East and of American needs for weapons, I should say that there is a recent development that has attracted a huge amount of controversy in China, and that is that Taiwan has now started to conduct exercises using ATACMS missiles. These are the same missiles that the Biden administration supplied to Ukraine, 500 of them in total, according to the US media, 500 ATACMS missiles supplied to Ukraine. Bear in mind that it seems that the United States no longer makes them, and that the replacement for the ATACMS is still only in the design phase, just say. But anyway, there was a massive drain of ATACMS missiles supplied by the Biden administration to Ukraine. Ukraine used them against Russia, both in the area of the special military operation and in conducting strikes against Russia itself, in violation, by the way, of President Putin's red lines. the ATACMS missiles achieved virtually nothing, certainly nothing of any value in military terms. But anyway, these are the same missiles that were used and which failed against Russia, and apparently they're now being supplied in large numbers to Taiwan, and Taiwan is conducting exercises with them. And it's been pointed out that from the territory of Taiwan, they could, at least in theory, reach the Chinese mainland, some parts of the Chinese mainland. I would add that these ATACMS missiles, when we say that they are having supplied to Taiwan, that is actually unlikely to be true. During the conflict in Ukraine, as everyone knows, as Vladimir Putin pointed out, as the United States never actually denied, the ATACMS missiles were actually guided and operated by the United States itself. It was American officials who basically operated the strikes of the ATACMS, who selected the targets, who uploaded the necessary guidance information onto the missiles, and who were ultimately responsible for guiding, launching the missiles themselves. And there is every reason to think that the same is true in Taiwan, that the United States, again, is heavily, directly involved in the Taiwan deployments and in the Taiwan exercises. Now, why do I talk about this? Because, of course, the Chinese are extremely unhappy about this deployment of ATACMS missiles, to put it mildly, and they are going to start taking counter steps, obviously, and we know that their resources dwarf Russia's, and by the way, they also dwarf the United States. Those are the United States because of their enormous industrial base. And by the way, they absolutely, overwhelmingly dwarf Taiwan's. So given that there is this confrontation over Taiwan between China and the United States, putting aside the fact that we're about to see a massive drain of American resources against American resources from any conflict with Iran, the crisis with China, which at a military level seems to be worsening, again, people are not noticing this. The CIA is now trying to use what it believes to be instability in the top military leadership of China's military following the sacking of Zhang Yusui by Xi Jinping. Anyway, the United States is now trying to use this seeming instability to recruit spies within the Chinese military, and has openly said as much. It's actually publishing advertisements which are addressed specifically to these spies. Anyway, given the deterioration in the situation with China, given the rapidly developing crisis in the Middle East with Iran, given what we have long known, what has been discussed by people like Brian Beletic and Alex Vershinin of the Royal United Services Institute, and to some extent, of course, by me, about the instabilities of US weapons procurement, a topic also extensively discussed in the US media as well, by the way. there will simply not be enough weapons soon for Ukraine, enough weapons to spare to keep Ukraine going in the war. Now, given that that is so, we are rapidly approaching that point, if we haven't reached it already, where American material help to Ukraine is going to start to dwindle. And of course, the Americans will continue to provide some help. They will continue to provide intelligence assistance. They will continue to provide, no doubt, Ukraine with a lot of help with its drone war, just say. But if you are in Europe, if you are wholly committed to the war in Ukraine, you must be getting increasingly worried that the Americans are going to soon reduce their involvement and might even before long actually take steps, not just to reduce their involvement, but to walk away. There were even reports circulating just a few days ago that because of the midterms, the time, the campaigning time relating to the midterms, the United States itself, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, is already signalling that he will no longer be in a position to devote time to the Ukraine issue beyond the early summer. From that moment, his focus has to be the midterms rather than Ukraine. And again, if you are a very, very hardline person in Britain, in Europe, and you nonetheless still want to keep the conflict with Russia going, despite the fact that the Americans no longer seem committed to it, then of course you've got to keep the European public and European governments on side. And Germany obviously is keen to keep this going, at least Chancellor Merz is, though there are increasing doubts being expressed in Germany, and the AfD is obviously hostile. And of course in Britain, and to some extent also in France, Starmer and Macron seem increasingly to be basing whatever politics they are still able to do in their current weakened state around the question of the ongoing crusade against the evil Putin in Moscow, who is threatening to absorb and take over Europe. So if you put it all like that, it's not difficult to understand why a story like that, like this strange story about Navalny, should be resurrected today. It's in fact entirely in character to try to remind everybody about what a bad man Vladimir Putin is, the extraordinary and sinister lengths to which he is prepared to go at a time when support for Ukraine, or rather for the war there, and support for Europe's general confrontation with Russia at a popular level is draining away. Now, all of this, of course, brings me back to the situation in the war. Now, over the course of the last night, we did not have another big Russian strike on Ukraine. We did have Ukrainian attempts to conduct drone strikes against Russia, but I've discussed many times how these are far less effective than many people in my experience believe. And I think the evidence of that, by the way, is overwhelming. And by the way, it is starting to be acknowledged even by those who support these drone operations by Ukraine against Russia. But we have also now had information about the state on the front lines from no less a person than General Valery Gerasimov, the chief of the general staff of the Russian armed forces, the main military official in Russia, and the overall commander of Russian forces in the zone of the special military operation. And General Gerasimov visited one of the Russian group of forces. He actually visited, I believe, the headquarters of group of forces center again, and he provided a detailed report, a very detailed report, of the overall state of the military situation on the battlefronts. And there is again an accompanying video, and the video is interesting. It shows Gerasimov meeting the various Russian military officers and handing out decorations and doing all of those sort of things. It's perhaps a little less revealing than some of the other videos we've seen in the past. And of course, his presentation was very carefully prepared. Now, this presentation takes place even as we've been having a cascade of reports about the Ukrainian counteroffensive in Zaporozhye region, the counteroffensive that is supposed to be taking place in the eastern part of Zaporozhye region. And I will anticipate by saying that even as we get all sorts of excited reports, which must ultimately originate from Ukraine, even as some of these reports are taken extremely seriously by some of the mapping projects, including the Western mapping projects, even as these mapping projects show, well, significant areas of territory in eastern Zaporozhye region passing back under Ukrainian control, we get from Gerasimov himself a completely different account of the matter. Now, I say that he didn't speak actually about the situation in Zaporozhye specifically very much. He said that the Russians in eastern Zaporozhye are continuing to advance. He identified some places that the Russians in eastern Zaporozhye have still captured. He said that the Ukrainians have redeployed some of their best troops to this territory. And he did accept that the Ukrainians are conducting attacks or counterattacks there. But he said that all of these counterattacks are being repelled. And I believe that this is true. I say this again, there is a notable absence of drone footage from Ukraine to corroborate many of the claims that have been made. In fact, I'd say all of the claims that have been made. For example, the Ukrainians claim that they have recaptured various villages in eastern Zaporozhye. But so far, I haven't seen drone footage or footage, video footage, provided by Ukraine from a single one of these villages. Now, Ukraine, in my experience, is always very, very quick to provide video footage to confirm whatever claim, real or not, that it is making. If there's any possibility of providing drone footage, the Ukrainians always seize on it. The public relations part of the war has always been given far higher priority in Ukraine than it is in Russia. Just saying. So the fact that the Ukrainians are not providing drone footage would in itself lead me to think that Gerasimov overall is right. Now, I say that, I would add something else here, which is, again, it's been fairly standard practice by many bloggers and war reporters whenever Gerasimov makes a report which looks to be ahead of the information that the bloggers and reporters and reporting channels and mapping projects have charted. It's often the case that these people say that Gerasimov's claims must be wrong, that he's obviously not telling the truth, that he's lying, perhaps even lying to President Putin himself, except that after a certain gap in time, when we do start to get information, it turns out that either what Gerasimov says was indeed true all along, or if Gerasimov was ahead of events in some particular place, it was not by very much. So I remember that back in the autumn, for example, he said there was street fighting in Siversk, and Siversk has now fallen. He made all sorts of claims about the situation in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, and both of those places have now fallen. There's a report, by the way, which says there are some claims that say that Gerasimov spoke about the Russians being only in control of southern Mirnograd. I watched the video. I never heard him say that. I don't know where that originates from. Just saying. And, well, even as that is going on, he also, of course, pushed back against Ukrainian claims about the successful Ukrainian counteroffensive in Kupiansk. And there's still controversy and argument about what did in fact take place. But nobody seriously disputes anymore that it is the Russians who hold the initiative in Kupiansk, and that the Ukrainians are being pushed back, and that the Ukrainians never captured the center of Kupiansk, and that the Russians, as Gerasimov actually said in his latest report, have now almost completed the elimination of the Ukrainian forces that were trapped on the east bank of the Oskol. So why not accept Gerasimov's account of what is going on in Zaporozhye region? It conforms with my own impressions. And as I said in my program yesterday, Scott of Calibrated seems to have similar views about the progress of this Ukrainian offensive in eastern Zaporozhye as I do, that yes, counterattacks are taking place. Yes, small groups of Ukrainian soldiers do sometimes manage to infiltrate and move far behind the Russian lines, but that ultimately this offensive will fail because the Ukrainians lack the power, lack the ability, lack the men to sustain it. Perhaps more interesting, going back to what Gerasimov was saying, was his indications about what is likely to happen over the next couple of weeks. So I noticed, for example, that he spoke about continued Russian advances towards Slavyansk, which suggests to me that certainly in the spring or early summer, the Russians are going to start operations to capture Slavyansk itself. He spoke about how various villages close to Liman, Drobusheva, for example, are about to fall under Russian control. He spoke also about the situation in Konstantinovka and said that the Russians continue to make progress there. He said, by the way, contradicting claims that the situation with the counterattack in Zaporozhye is where the main fighting is taking place at the moment. He repeated that the main fighting is taking place in the area of responsibility of Group of Forces Center, that is to say, in Donbass, in the area of Pokrovsk specifically. And he also, and this is, I thought, the most interesting part of what he said, he specifically said that over the course of his visit to the headquarters of Group of Forces Center, the second visit, by the way, that he has made to this particular headquarters in, I believe, a month, which gives a clear sense that this is, for the Russians, the main area of priority. Anyway, he spoke about future operations by Group of Forces Center in Dnipropetrovsk region. And he seemed to suggest that this might be the main area of priority. Could it be that Gerasimov is now talking with Group of Forces Center about an advance westwards towards the cities of Pavlograd at Dnipro on the Dnieper River? The way to do so is open. The only two places left, as far as I'm aware, that stand in the way of the Russian army are Novopavlivka, and I noticed that Gerasimov specifically mentioned that place and spoke about the need to complete its capture. Novopavlivka, a fortified town in western Dnipropetrovsk region. Battles have been taking place there since the early autumn. The Russians have never, however, committed enough troops to capture it. Perhaps they will now do so. And of course, the other place a bit further north is Dobropilia, the important town to the northwest of Pokrovsk. And with the Russians having now secured Rodinska and apparently close to securing Belitska, and also Grishino, which Gerasimov also mentioned, it looks to me as if operations to bring Dobropilia under Russian control might also begin fairly soon. In which case, the big story of the summer campaign might be, obviously, the completion of operations in Donbass, but a major Russian advance westwards towards the Dnieper, towards Zaporozhye City, and towards Dnipro as well. And as I've discussed many times, that would be a killer blow. I remember about 2 years ago, the dissident Ukrainian magazine, website magazine, Strana, actually said that one of the events which might indeed bring about the collapse of Ukraine would be the fall, the Russian capture of the cities of Zaporozhye and Dnipro. Zaporozhye, when the Russians reach it, would be relatively straightforward. By far the bigger part of the city is located on the east bank of the Dnieper. The Russians can cut off the supply routes across the bridges into Zaporozhye, and it would be a relatively straightforward thing for the Russians to capture the city. Dnipro would be a much more complicated proposition altogether. It is located on both sides of the river and also in islands, various islands in the river itself. So this would be a very complicated operation to carry out. But then if the Russians advance to Dnipro from the east, and capture Zaporozhye in the south, one can begin to see how it might be possible. Anyway, this is speculation on my part, and one should never overlook the possibility that a degree of misdirection from the Russians is taking place. But anyway, I did find Gerasimov's comments interesting, and I thought I would highlight them. Of course, and to repeat again, if the Russians capture Zaporozhye and Dnipro, that puts them in an exceptionally strong position, not just to break Ukraine, but to advance westwards towards Odessa in the south and northwards towards Kiev as well. Now, Gerasimov did have some other very interesting things to say. He said that the Russians are advancing on every part of the front line. He claimed that the Russians, despite the difficult weather conditions, have captured 200 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory in the first 2 weeks of February. He also, by the way, said that the Russians now have twice as many drones in the sky over the battlefields of Ukraine than the Ukrainians do. Now, it's been often claimed that the one area where the Ukrainians have rough parity with the Russians is in drones over the battlefields. Gerasimov says it otherwise. I have no doubt at all that he is right, and I'm going to suggest that over the next year, the difference between numbers of drones that the Russians can put up over the battlefields and Ukrainian drones is going to widen. Anyway, that's Gerasimov. Now, all of this should be very ominous for Ukraine. And clearly some of the concerns, some of the doubts about the future are shared by at least some Ukrainian political figures. The mayor of Kiev, Mayor Klitschko, who is, by the way, in open conflict with Zelensky. Anyway, Klitschko gave a long interview to the Financial Times, over the course of which he said that Ukraine's existence, very existence as a state, is still in question. It's 50-50. That's the impression I got reading his article, his interview. Whether Ukraine survives the conflict at all. Of course, what he probably means by Ukraine is not a country called Ukraine or a state called Ukraine. Rather, it is the kind of Ukraine that has existed since 2014, or perhaps, if you prefer, since 1991. A Ukraine that is, in effect, not just independent from Russia, but also in an adversary state to it. Now, as to that, I have repeatedly said that, in my opinion, Russian officials are now fairly openly talking about the possibility of regime change in Ukraine. And we've now had a fairly lengthy interview by a very senior Russian deputy foreign ministry official, Deputy Foreign Minister Galuzin, who is indeed a very senior diplomat. And he's floated various possibilities. And he's discussed the possibility of elections in Ukraine. He said that elections could take place in Ukraine, and that if there were elections, the Russians would promise not to conduct air attacks on Ukraine on the day when the elections were taking place. Well, that was one of the things that Galuzin said. But he also said something else, which I found very interesting, and which the Russians have sort of floated before, but which looks to me now to becoming, in effect, a Russian proposal, and perhaps before very long, a Russian demand. This is that because Zelensky is he's holding office unconstitutionally because he has no legal authority to be president of Ukraine and has had no legal authority to be president of Ukraine since the expiry of his term in May 2024, the way forward might be to place Ukraine under UN trusteeship, a UN trusteeship which would then make possible the holding of elections, which would then determine the eventual political shape of Ukraine, and which would result in a new government in Ukraine with which the Russians could not only negotiate, but with which they could legally and constitutionally sign a peace agreement. Now, this is exactly the sort of proposal that you would imagine Putin, the lawyer, which is what he ultimately is, coming up with. And of course, what it actually is, if you strip away all of the finery, what it actually is a demand for regime change. It says that Zelensky holds office unconstitutionally. His position is illegal. The entire political structure in Kiev is rotten. It needs to be completely replaced, since there's no obvious way to establish an alternative leader. Let us do so by putting Ukraine under external trusteeship. And of course, the Russians, as they would always do, would initially suggest the United Nations, though Galuzin accepted that this isn't something that the United States Nations has done very much of in the past. But of course, if the United Nations is not able to do this, perhaps someone else can do it. Perhaps some other international organization can do it. Perhaps the BRICS, perhaps the Eurasian Economic Union, the Eurasian Union, which the Russians lead, perhaps the Collective Security Treaty Organization, or if none of that is possible, why not Russia itself? Just saying. Anyway, I suspect that at some point over the next few months, assuming the negotiations continue, this will become a Russian demand. Not a Russian proposal, but a Russian demand. I'm going to make a further guess that when the battles for Donbass end, when Donbass falls entirely under Russian control, when the Russians gain control of Zaporozhye region, we're going to see a public revision of the 14th June 2024 proposals, Istanbul Plus, the proposals that Putin outlined in his speech made to the foreign ministry on that day. At that time, Istanbul Plus will obviously be overtaken by events, we will see a new set of demands, much tougher, probably demands that exclude the possibility of Ukraine joining the European Union, just saying, but also demands that Ukraine be placed under trusteeship, that Zelensky himself step down and all of his officials do, and that Ukraine be placed under external trusteeship, an external trusteeship which would ultimately be guided by Russia. Now, recent actions taken by the United States make it easier for the Russians to suggest to the Americans that this is not an improper way forward. After all, since the abduction of Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, isn't that not what the Americans say that they are doing with respect to Venezuela? That they're taking overall control of Venezuela, that they're guiding its economic policies and its foreign policies, that they are selling for Venezuela its oil, which they and they alone are able to export. Why, the US President Donald Trump is himself now floating the possibility that he might go to Venezuela and meet with Dercy Rodriguez, the current interim president there. Obviously going there, not as just a prominent foreign visitor, but as the overall overlord. Well, if the Americans are okay with themselves doing that with Venezuela, why not, the Russians might say, agree to the Russians doing that in Ukraine as well? After all, Ukraine matters to Russia far more than Venezuela does to the United States. And it's arguable, it's highly arguable. In fact, I would say that the Americans have no right or justification to do what they're doing to Venezuela. But the Russians could say, validly say, that their case for doing that very same thing in Ukraine is very, very much stronger. Just saying. Anyway, that I think is where the conflict is going. Anyway, in the meantime, we still get words coming out of Europe. And at the moment, by the way, it is mostly words. Zelensky continues to rule out. He did so again, the Financial Times has reported it, any substantive compromise over Ukraine. He accepted very grudgingly in March that there should be a ceasefire. This is what the Americans insisted on, and he agreed to it because he had no choice. But he's very unhappy about doing that, but at least that is what he's sticking to. He's not prepared to make any further concessions whatsoever. He's not prepared to pull out of Donbass. He's not prepared to make any changes to the status of Russian speakers. He's not prepared to reinstate the Russian Orthodox Church. He's not prepared to give the Russian language any formal recognition at all. I understand that Russian is no longer taught in Ukrainian schools, even though most of the children who go to those schools, their first language is in fact Russian. I actually read a report a couple of days ago that the Ukrainian Minister of Culture is now imposing a blanket ban on all Russian literature in Ukraine, that books by Russian writers, any Russian writers, presumably that includes people like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and people like that, that they cannot be published in Ukraine, or even apparently circulated or sold in Ukraine. I am going to be very careful about believing that story. If it is true, I have to say that it absolutely would not surprise me. It would be completely consistent with the cultural policies that Ukraine's government has followed. For example, there was recently a sacking of two prominent Ukrainian ballet dancers who dance at the Kiev Ballet because they performed in Swan Lake, which is, of course, composed by a Russian composer, Tchaikovsky, and by the way, choreographed mostly by Russian choreographers, Lev Ivanov. Anyway, so perhaps the Ukrainians have taken the extreme step of banning all Russian books. Well, I'm not going to say definitely that I believe that to be true, because the only place I read it was in a Russian media outlet. And of course, they might be exaggerating and overstating things. Certainly, it does seem an extraordinary step to make. But as I said, regardless, there continues to be a general policy in Ukraine of Russian cultural suppression. And Zelensky is not prepared to retreat from any of that, even though his own first language, as it happens, is Russian. And as many Ukrainians have actually told me, he actually speaks Ukrainian rather badly. So Zelensky's prepared to make no concessions at all to end the conflict. He continues to take as hard a line as ever. And as for Europe, well, they continue to talk with each other and negotiate with each other. Starmer talks about sending, as I said, a British fleet to the Arctic. He continues to talk about support for Ukraine. In fact, this is now essentially reduced to his only policy, given that all of the others have failed. And other British and European officials do the same. There's been another extraordinary battle and argument between Macron and Merz, again about using the frozen Russian assets, so I understand. I thought that idea had been abandoned in December, but as I've said many times, in this conflict, no bad idea in the West is ever dropped for any particular length of time. Anyway, according to the reports, Macron and Merz have argued about whether the Russian assets should be used to buy weapons for Ukraine in general, including in the United States, or whether they should only be used to buy weapons for Ukraine in Europe. I wonder whether this isn't a misunderstanding about the 90 billion euro loan, which the Europeans agreed with each other should be provided to Ukraine in December. I would point out that we are now in February and there doesn't seem to have been any progress made in floating that loan at all. But anyway, they all talk, they continue to talk with each other, even as the sands run out. Now, in the meantime, we have this pending conflict in the Middle East, this big war with Iran coming. There are also growing reasons for concern about the state of the global economy. 2026 is starting to look like a crisis year. I have a feeling that it is in 2026 that a lot of things are going to happen altogether. And well, it could be the break, make or break moment for the Trump administration. Some people might not care much about that, but it could also be the year when, in terms of the collective West, we finally face a situation where it is no longer possible to pretend anymore that the time on the period of Western ascendancy is running out. It looks to me as if a desperate attempt is being prepared in Iran, perhaps in Far East Asia, to try to stop or reverse the flow of events. I get the sense that the Americans, at least in Ukraine, understand that the writing is on the wall there and that they are close to giving up. I may be wrong. If I am right, then this time next year, the world in which we will be in will be a completely different one. Anyway, this is where I finish my program today. Let me remind you once again that you can follow all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar by going to links under this video and by going to our shop. Also, please remember to check our Substack page site. Links for all of these things under this video. And last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.